Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 105, where we will discuss an article by Alvin Guldner titled Cosmopolitans and Locals Toward an Analysis of Latent Social Roles, published in two parts in consecutive issues of Administrative Science Quarterly in 1957 and 1958. This is part one of the episode, where we will focus on the first article, in which Guldner argues about the distinction between manifest and latent roles, and that the latter needs more attention. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Sam calling from Mexico City.
Hey, everyone. This is Rohin from London.
This is Sarah calling from London.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the beginning of summer. In this episode, we're going to cover a two-parter, an article that was stretched out across two editions of Administrative Science Quarterly. It is called Cosmopolitans and Locals Toward an Analysis of Latent Social Roles. And this is our second episode in which we're covering Alvin Guldner. And Guldner wrote this in 1957, which was a little bit after we go back to episode 78 when we covered his Patterns of Industrial Bureaucracy. That was published in 1954. This was published 3 years later, and it references Patterns of Industrial Bureaucracy in here. So would someone like to go ahead and introduce us to the work?
Yeah, I can do it. Okay, so yes, as Paul mentioned, this is a study that Guldner conducted at a small university. And this is a study that is published in two parts. So the first part came out in 1957, the second part came out in 1958. And so the kind of reference, theoretical reference of this text is role theory in sociology. And Guldner starts us off with a critique about how when sociologists have studied roles, they've mostly focused on the formal official roles instead of the more kind of hidden identities that also have a very big effect on the behavior of the group. And he introduces this distinction between what he calls manifest roles, which would refer to these more formal official roles, and the latent roles and identities, which basically mean all these identities that are ascribed to people and then the expectations that come out of those identities. And even though these latent roles and identities tend to be more informal and official, perhaps even considered illegitimate or inappropriate, they do have a big impact on how organizations work and how people behave within organizations. Talking about these latent identities and roles, he especially develops these first part, these two big categories of cosmopolitan and local, as he calls them. And cosmopolitans are basically, I mean, we'll get into this in a deeper discussion, but cosmopolitans are those that tend to have a lower commitment to the organization. They favor networks that are outside the organizations, where locals are very much committed and loyal to the organization itself. So this is basically what he does in part one, you know, explain the difference between latent and manifest roles and explain the difference between cosmopolitans and locals in terms of commitment, professional skills and values, loyalty to the organization, and the reference group orientations. In part two, what Guldner does is go deeper into these two categories and defines four types of locals: the dedicated, the true bureaucrat, the home guard, and the elders. And two types of cosmopolitans, the outsiders and the empire builders. And he discusses these types in detail and then reflects on the implications that these latent roles have for formal organization and informal relations.
Yeah, thank you for that, Sam. And part two also provides a very detailed look in the factor analysis that went into differentiating those six different roles, the two cosmopolitan and the four local. For some of us, the level of detail probably is not something we would see in an article published nowadays. And we can talk about that later, too, because it was a bit odd that this article was divided across two editions. Like nowadays, you would think that a study of this type would have been published in one shot. It was kind of in the early days of Administrative Science Quarterly, so, you know, could very well be they needed to fill the pages. Not to totally steal from Rowan. But
also, if you look at the beginning of part two, it talks about the use of the new technology, the Iliac computer, that allows the user a rapid solution for what's really some complex matrix algebra at the time with 125 survey respondents. But remember, this is not long after Enigma. So a rapid solution still means set it and go away and come back tomorrow to potentially get some useful numbers out. So there is a lot of data churned with the inputs, even though it seems super simplified with these tables. So it is small by modern standard and a small investigation, single site, single set of sample but I think what's really important is that in both parts, he's trying to focus the audience on construct definitions, validity, differentiation from other things. He happens to do a factor analysis. He happens to collect these small interviews with people in different roles across the university, but it was never the intention to do a strong, empirically grounded investigation as much as it was to sort of plant a flag. And so I think that's important to remember as we go through what was done and what was found.
Yeah, since we're on the brief detour of the presentation or format of the paper, the other interesting thing, which we don't read as much, is the exposition style where he kind of takes us through each micro step of the analysis and then discusses the results from that and his interpretations of that. For example, correlation by correlation almost in some points of the paper, as opposed to doing it all and then telling us what the overall kind of, let's say, model or factor analysis in his case suggests, which made it a bit of a challenging read where I would rather have just I guess this is me confessing that I would have skipped over the methods and just read all the interpretations and results if it weren't for the fact that they were so deeply interspersed with the methodology.
Yeah, I guess as someone who's coming at this from a more of a practical lens, I sort of appreciated that step-by-step approach because sometimes, especially with factor analysis, it can be very difficult to see the clustering the way that the author sees it. I sort of appreciated that. It helped me understand where he was coming from in differentiating all of these latent roles. I think what we should do is kind of walk through the beginning of the first is, it was mentioned that we had the differentiation put forth between manifest and latent social identities. And it all begins with his opening salvo. It's basically, how are we using role theory? A social role, as he put it, it's commonly defined as a set of expectations oriented towards people who occupy a certain position. And so role theory at the time was focused on the manifest, what Guldner would call the manifest or role identity. What he's trying to do is he's trying to open the aperture here and say, well, there's all of these other role identities that we don't understand, that nobody's paying attention to. We're so focused on what the position demands and whether people are fulfilling the requirements of the position. There is this other set of phenomena about how people bring themselves into the role that's just simply not accounted for. And so the beginning is all about trying to set that stage and try to define terms and build a lexicon that will ultimately lead to this discovery of these six latent role identities.
I think what's also important in situating this paper is the absolute moment in sociology and the birth of modern management studies. So this comes the year after Irving Goffman publishes The Presentation of the Self in Everyday Life. And it's exactly the same time as Robert Merton is establishing structural sociology, which itself will lead to network studies. And some of the language that Guldner uses, even on page 2 of part 1, where he says, it is a rare discussion of social role that does not at some point make reference to the quote-unquote position occupied by a group member. That is the beginning of network studies in both of the disciplines. So I can't comment on whether the level of awareness he had to what Merton was building in Columbia, the Chicago movements, you know, that it was a smaller world and higher awareness back then. So we can assume that even if he wasn't involved in those founding discussions, he was aware of them.
Yeah. And we should quickly mention, I mean, in regards to the relationship you were noticing, Merton was Goldner's advisor at Columbia where he did his PhD. So that's, yeah, that's why we see a nice parallel. And he even brings back Merton at the end in the conclusion in trying to describe what kind of contribution he's making with these new concepts.
I knew that he had been there. I didn't know whether they had a lovely relationship or not. So this is a very difficult line to walk, to contribute to something that these two behemoths have started, but also to deliver something new and different. Not that different to what junior scholars find themselves having to be deferential to the existing canon and then say, but here is my gap and my baby that I will now spend 5 years developing and delivering to the world. So that's what I think is so exciting about this is that it's bringing that piece from sociology and the new sociology into the new management studies. I don't know how many other very quantitative management scholars at the time would have been au fait with Goffman.
Yeah, also in fact, in his acknowledgments in the paper, well, at least in part one, he acknowledges a bunch of people, but he kind of singles out Robert Merton and Paul Lazarsfeld as two people who've very closely read the manuscript and given him feedback. And Paul Lazarsfeld was one of the people who was at the vanguard of kind of the more quantitative empirical approaches at the time as well, which explains your observation as well, Sarah.
I guess what we can do is then look at when he then labels the manifest and the latent social identities, he puts in this statement that I thought was really interesting. It's on page 284. Social identities have to do with the way in which an individual is in fact perceived, italicized, and classified by others in terms of a system of culturally standardized categories. And I think the emphasis on the word perceived is really interesting here, because I think not just are we trying to move away from how a position defines, but trying to move away from a purely structural look at how role identities are defined. What is perceived by others, which could very well be different from what is actually the case. When we're talking about latent social identities, I mean, the word latent itself means hidden. It's something that people bring into the role that he's trying to capture that is not directly observable,
I think you make a great point, Tom, because this is also, it's very nice to read, and we've done an episode on patterns of industrial bureaucracy before, and now this, and it's really interesting to see kind of the path that Goldner is building and then how he eventually gets to, you know, making a stronger and clearer critique on sociology and how we need to start studying more the things that are not so obvious or formalized and this attention to the subjective as well. I think it's very important. And he starts with, he lists at some point in the justification of why we should be caring about these latent roles, these set of questions, which if we read them now, it's, you kind of laugh because they're very obvious to us now, right? But I'm just going to read a couple. So are the career chances of industrial workers affected by their ethnic identity? Do college professors take note of and behave somewhat differently toward members of college football team who are taking their courses, right? So he's alluding to this idea of people have multiple identities. Some of them are more salient or important than others in certain organizations. But what is clear is that we don't just form expectations on the roles of people based on the formal role and assigned role, but on all these other roles that they also occupy, right? So I think it's a really beautiful, like, I always love reading these older papers because they make, not basic, but like, yeah, in a way, like basic observations that were not so basic before, right? So it's really nice to kind of draw attention to that, I think.
Yeah, and this also ties into Tom's point about how he emphasizes the word perception and how it's from the alter's perspective rather than ego perspective, if I am to borrow from network terminology. So for me, for example, before this, I had more frequently come across the term social identity in the social psychological literature, where it's about what kind of social group you feel like you belong to or you draw your identity from. Goldner does a great job on page 283, where he gives us kind of a four-step process of the interaction, and where kind of step one is where you perceive certain characteristics of this person that you're interacting with. Step two is that you then link those characteristics to a category. So he calls it a culturally prescribed set of categories. Step three is that you then ascribe or assign an identity based on what you've done in step one and two. And then step four, now that you've arrived at this conclusion about this person, or at least a temporary situational conclusion, you mobilize your beliefs based on that category or that social identity. And so the reason this is important is because, to use the example of professor and student, I could be a student where my salient identity is that I'm a student, and let's say my latent identity is that I'm, a father or an athlete. But there's one side of this dynamic where that might affect how I approach work or I'm experiencing identity conflict. But Goldner is very much interested in the other side, where how is the professor treating me based on whether I'm also an athlete or a parent, and what those latent identities are.
Yeah, the two terms that you need are consensual regard and culturally standardized categories. So in other words, it's kind of a hard line that says it doesn't really matter what you think of yourself, or it doesn't really matter how you would like to come across, which is very much Goffman's contribution there, that you are an actor in a stage and you can switch roles and you can inhabit different personas. And the contribution here says, we're not so much interested in that anymore. And then what you think you are presenting might be completely different from what other people think about you. And so from here on, we're going to look at how those alters in the network language, or how audience, what the audience gets from your performance, and what that unlocks for you in all of the other similar avenues. So he talks about relations to status. He talks about relations to labor mobility. He talks about relations to internal promotion and power. There's a lot of power and dynamic in here as well. And those are the things that matter when the audience, because they're all things that the audience gives you, or that the group permits you to have, or makes possible for you. And so that's the real bright line we're drawing here.
And then Alvin brings it, well, I'm going on a first name basis here. Alvin brings it back full circle on page 285, where he invokes George Herbert Mead and talks about how if the professor does keep treating you as if you are an athlete who doesn't care about academics, etc., that will in turn shape your self-conception. So it comes back to even your beliefs about yourself.
I want to quickly jump on that. I might be getting ahead of myself, but I wanted to see if you felt the same thing, because when he poses this theoretically, I agree with you. But then when I think about how he eventually comes up with these different types of locals and cosmopolitans and what they do, that I feel that there's a tension, because there it's pretty obvious that these groups self-identify and take pride and power and whatever you want to call it from being that type of local or that type of cosmopolitan. So it does, I don't know, like I felt that there was a kind of disconnection between what he originally sets out to do theoretically and then the implications of what he finds empirically. But we can get to that later.
Yeah, that's a fair comment, because I actually had the same struggle, because we're looking on the one hand, we're setting up a story in which we're talking about perceptions, but then there is what do I know that I bring to the role identity? That will definitely come up when we start getting into the details of what the two cosmopolitan and four local latent identities are, which I suppose part of this was just a outcome of how did they actually come up with what these latent identities are in the first place and how they bucketed them. Because obviously with this sort of an analysis, sometimes the buckets are a bit leaky, and what we might interpret as you know, the practical meaning of one of these latent role identities may differ among the four of us. I think what we could do is get into the actual definition of cosmopolitan and local. And those definitions are found on page 290. Well, they're not really definitions per se. They're more descriptions than anything else, because the local is those who are high on loyalty to the employing organization, low on commitment to specialized role skills, and likely to use an inner reference group orientation. Actually, what I should do is say that what Guldner derived at were three variables that he's going to use to analyze the latent identities, and the cosmopolitans and the locals represent opposite ends of the spectrum along these three variables. So with locals are high on loyalty, low on commitment to specialized role skills, likely to use an inner reference group. Cosmopolitans, which the word suggests somebody who goes from place to place in essence, it's those who are low on loyalty to the employing organization, high on commitment to specialized role skills, and likely to use an outer reference group orientation. So, you know, contrasting the two, you know, one is very externally oriented, one is very internally oriented, and that's the starting point. That's the categorization, the two broad categories. And then later on, again, through the study, he breaks them out into different types.
Yeah, and I would just add that he does this, I can't remember where he says this, but he talks about these two groups as representing that simultaneous need of organizations for loyalty and expertise, which I think it's really nice, because it shows that, you know, if you just read the definitions, you would think why an organization would want to engage with cosmopolitans, right? But I think that phrase really explains nicely why both groups are necessary in any organization.
But the reason that it's expertise, or the reason expertise is problematized, is on the bottom of 288, it says, the expert is more likely than others to esteem the good opinion of professional peers elsewhere. He is disposed to seek recognition and acceptance from quote unquote outsiders. And so if I had a critique for this project, I'm sure we will come back to that in the second half of this episode. But for me, this problematizes the direction of causality already, which is that the classification talks about expertise, which is market offering, which is mobility, which is progression, not just in an academic context, as we know, but in many organizations, what you have to offer versus what you need from your organization. And so if you have high expertise, which is defined as external esteem, you are by definition externally facing. And therefore, you're already a cosmopolitan on this dichotomy. There's no room for you to doubly invest or double down on your investment in your organization to serve that expertise internally for the health and the success of the organization. Because by the nature that Guldner set up, you have to constantly be testing the market, updating your knowledge, refining your niche. So at this early in the project and in part one, that was the one issue that I had before we even get to measurement, was that tension that Sam was describing is also in the definition, because the way he describes loyalty, which is page 291, loyalty implies a willingness to limit or relinquish the commitment to a specialized professional task, i.e. expertise, and a dominant career orientation to the employing organization as reference group. So again, that's a bright line between the two of them, which is not just internally and externally facing, but it's about self-sacrifice. It's about ambition. It's about dedication of resources, much more than role and identity.
Well, we're on the subject of problematizing a bit these theoretical ideas, the other thing that I, like, it took me a while to just accept it and accept that I wasn't going to figure it out and move on, was also in page 291, he makes this distinction between, you know, the cynics, clock watchers, the people that are just doing time, basically, and the people that believe in the task and really care and go above and beyond. And that, for me, it's also kind of, it's a contradictory in a way, because here you would refer to the locals as the clock watchers that are just doing time, if you want to like oversimplify. And then the cosmopolitans is the one that are that believe in or are fired up by the task. But that then doesn't really make sense with the part of who would be more appreciated or seen as more committed, right? So there's also this weird thing about separating the organization from the work it does in a way, right? Like it's as if they can be separated or they, you know, as or as if an organization would value people that are loyal to the organization but not to the work, which seems kind of, yeah. I found that very confusing.
Yeah, and I think part of this is perhaps just when we think about why he's doing the study, what I interpreted that paragraph, because I had it highlighted, these are like, if I'm going into an organization looking at something that I've never looked at before, I'm trying to interpret the language being used. And I think he put those in those phrases in quotes, because here it is, he's hearing these this language in among the people there, and he's recognizing at least initially some sort of pattern that says that, okay, there's an understanding that there are people who are there solely for their own benefit and who really are not contributing to the organization versus those who firmly feel obligated or love being in the organization. It's like two completely different types of commitment, because he prefaces that statement with a distinction is commonly made, which is brilliant passive voice. It, you know, it's just a, I heard this, this is what I'm seeing and I'm observing. And what I want to do is I want to try to find a way to, using these definitions of cosmopolitans and locals and the survey that I'm about to do, I'm going to try to make real good sense of that there's more than one type of cosmopolitan and local. Like it isn't just about expertise and loyalty. It's also, I want to see if I can put some definition behind the way that people are using these offhand terms that they're just throwing around it around the water cooler. So that's kind of how I took that.
Qualitative research from a quantitative researcher.
What's wrong with that? Rowan, you had something. Go ahead.
But yeah, I just wanted to come back to the point Sam was making about separating the work and the organization and what's actually good for the work versus loyalty and commitment to the organization. There's definitely a latent variable within his analysis of latent variables, which is ambition. And so ambition seems to align all along, kind of, even when he breaks it up into types of cosmopolitans and locals, ambition seems to be on the side of the cosmos. That's not my nickname, that's his that he uses in the paper. And the locals are not as driven. But at the same time, the reason it works in this paper, and that's actually a limitation of this paper, is that his setting is a higher education institution. It's a college, and that kind of limits how much you would expect this. So in a college, for example, the ambition of a cosmopolitan to be kind of a research star, it helps the college, but in kind of indirect ways, sure, you've got publication counts, it might add to your FT rankings or something like that. But it doesn't help as much as, let's say, the ambition of someone who's also fully dedicated. I mean, I'm not yet in administration, so I don't know, but I assume administration is useful since the college needs to run. And so there is coming back to, again, Sam's terminology, even within work now, there is work for the building of the institution and work that indirectly helps the institution through association, but ultimately builds the career of the individual, as opposed to if you're working at Unilever or something, where maybe the cosmos and locals analysis would be different.
Yeah, Rowan, can we pick up with that? Because I think that's an unspoken truth of this project, is that it's a study on academia itself. So it's not like the Hawthorne studies. It's not an automotive assembly line. It's not a context that is deeply practical. It's not like any of the things in Tom's expertise that we have spoken about in other episodes. And so I wonder how much of this, if we were being critical as a friendly reviewer, we would say how much is generalizable, right? Especially the labor market they're talking about, the large size of administration. You know, there are a couple of places throughout the article that you can smile, give yourself a knowing smile, like when it says, all of those listed in either roster were entirely clerical or secretarial, and they all agreed to be interviewed. The five who refused to be interviewed, four of those were heads of department. lots of little places like that where if you're on the inside, you can have a little chuckle to yourself, and that deepens your belief in the context and in the results. But I wonder how many other organizations at the time, even if we limit ourselves to knowledge economy or white collar jobs in the late 50s, early 60s, how many other organizations would shake out as similarly as the model that we're being asked to follow along with? So I just wanted to know your thoughts on that. Did anybody else prick their ears when they first started reading? Or is studying, turning the lens of inquiry onto ourselves such a given now that we are just one context among many?
Yeah, in my reading, I think I got more and more skeptical about the generalizability or transferability of this as I got to part two and as he started unpacking the types of cosmopolitans and locals. And then it started sounding like, okay, now you're just talking about admin staff. You're just talking about old tenured professors versus the younger ones and so on and so forth. And it seemed quite context specific. What I found more compelling was early on, even before the survey results, where he's just talking about the problem of experts in organizations. And so this is around page 288, because I immediately saw how there's research today being done on those points. So for example, he talks about how experts tend to be people who never seem to win the complete confidence of the company's highest authorities and are kept removed from the highest reaches of power. That immediately reminded me of Giulia Di Bernino's paper on rapid relationality and how do you get influence when you are kept at a distance. Elsewhere, he talks about something that reminded me of, I guess, Karunakaran's work on status authority asymmetries. So I found him most compelling when he was just setting up the concept of experts in organizations, especially within the context of old school organizations. In today's world, perhaps the thing gets further problematized, and we can talk about that later. But as he got to the empirics and started trying to be more fine-grained by breaking up types of cosmos and locals, the insights became much less generalizable to me.
Yeah, and it also seems like what you eventually are left with in this, the four types of locals and the two types of cosmopolitans are the latent manifestations of manifest roles, right? Because you, like you said before, like it's really easy to classify them as, okay, these are the secretaries. Okay, these are the older senior faculty members. These are like, it's so easy to align what he is calling latent roles with actual manifest roles that it kind of, yeah, I agree with you. I found the beginning more compelling. And to go back to Sarah's question, it's not an old organization because it still functions like this, but it has been functioning like this for a while. But I study workers in public administration in Mexico. And at the beginning, I was excited of how I could like use these reflections to the settings that I study, because in Mexico, basically, you have two types of public servants. You have the trust workers, which are the experts that have not a lot of job security. They kind of change with each administration. They move to a different public organization. And then you have the base workers, which are the ones that are unionized and you cannot get rid of them. And that's how I was finding this tension with the clock watchers and the people that are super committed to the task, because usually what you see in public administration in Mexico is the base workers are the ones that do the bare minimum. Like you'll find them napping in their desk. You know, this is of course a caricature, but you'll find them napping in their desk and they don't do anything. And they make up about 60 to 80% of the workforce in organizations. Whereas the trust workers, who would be more aligned to the cosmopolitans in the sense of they are the experts, you know, they have graduate education and they are very committed to public service and they just kind of rotate and they are there for a while. But they are the ones that are more committed in a lot of ways to the organization and to making it work and to actually fulfilling the techno-legal mandates of government agencies. And so, yeah, when I try to apply it to this setting, it just kind of didn't make much sense in a way. I mean, it was interesting, but didn't make much sense.
I was going to go in the same direction with the public sector, but my interpretation was actually different in that with us, the cosmopolitans are probably the ones whose their loyalty is to whatever agenda that, the mandate that they're following. The locals tend to be much more dedicated to the mission because they provide the continuity. Yes, they may have much more of a structured approach to work. Like they are paid by the hour, and when their shift ends, they're done. I'd say that many of them really are really devoted to the task. They take the same oath as the political appointees. It is just that their reference orientation is a bit different. What this speaks to is that there's a generalizable sense that there's a difference between a class of folks that we're calling cosmopolitan and a class of folks that we call locals. And the context is not just by organization. I think it's also by time. Over time, the meaning of public service probably means something different from 1950s to what it does today. So we might understand the role identities a little bit differently. The separation being there is still kind of useful, perhaps.
It would be cool I know this wasn't the point of the study, but to understand the relationship or the effect that manifest roles can have on latent roles, right? Because I was just thinking about this like old misconception, or maybe not so misconception, of faculty when they get tenure, right? And so they kind of, it will be really, that's a really clear case of where you have a cosmopolitan that becomes a local because you don't have this incentive anymore to be publishing, because you need to keep yourself attractive to other potential schools.
How cosmopolitans and locals are organized with each other. So on page 297, he talks about trying to measure the degree of influence that respondents have. And that's operationalized by asking, which of the following policy decisions are you in on? And they had to check from a list of 10, number one being deciding on the tenure of faculty members. Although he's very clear to say that the influence score was just a sum of ones and zeros, no effort was made to assign different weights to participation in different decision-making areas. So those of you who want to decide on colleagues forever and ever have no different influence than those who describe who contribute to student admissions. They're very clear. But again, 10 activities that keep the institution moving along, and your degree of influence is which of the following policy decisions are you in on? And I can't help but think also about how to make this slightly more sophisticated, that this is actually question zero. Are you even in the room when these things are decided? Yes, no. Then when you're in the room, or in this case, are you on the calendar invitation, right, in these days? But when you're in the room, do you get listened to? Do your contributions move the needle? That to me needs a hierarchical model of influence, not just a number between 1 and 10. But that just is trying to underscore the things that Simon was talking about how these forced groupings then interact with each other. And he goes on to talk about how these are perpetuated as well by bringing in what becomes a very important concept in network studies going forward, which is homophily. So he talks on 302, talking about, we are thus in a position to ascertain whether the latent social identity tended to influence patterns of sociability. Our hypothesis was that latent identity homophily tended to increase sociable interaction. That is, people have the same latent identity, were expected to be more sociable within each other than with those having a different latent identity. I mean, talk about an example of what Sam was describing as sort of basic social observation made harder than if it needs to. But it's attempting to measure, to demonstrate, to really grow the, as you said earlier, Rowan, the Lazarsfeld and Merton friendship as a social process, this definition of homophily and heterophily, and when would either approach be more advantageous. And so I think it comes back to what Sam set us up with at the introduction, which is that, okay, it's a forced grouping that might have some circular definitions, that might already have some foregone conclusions. But if you agree that there should be different constructs, which is all Guldner tried to do with this, was just to start talking about things as a different construct. If you agree with that from the beginning, and I love this. I have to include this in part one, page 292. The statistical paraphernalia that follow should not be allowed to obscure the fact that our principal objective was that of concept construction.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.